going to actually sit on this stool because when I brought my body back from India, it had some unwelcome visitors inside of it. And it's been a little unwell since I got back. I think my brain is functioning, but if it had to stand up for the whole thing, it might fall over. So we'll just talk. As most of you know, I've just returned from 8 weeks of a lecture tour in India, which I undertook at Swami Kriyananda's request. He'd asked me last June to think more globally, act globally, not merely think globally, and see myself as a person who'd carried Master's teachings beyond the borders of Palo Alto. I wasn't sure whether he meant India when he said the globe, but that's where we started. So from just after Master's birthday until Tuesday, I was on a lecture tour there. I've traveled to India many times, but I've never undertaken a lecture tour in that country, in any country outside of the U.S., and in no country at all for some 25 years. Once David and I settled here, the possibility of really tootling off and teaching in lots of places really just hasn't been an option. It was an extraordinary experience, which I'll tell you more about it later tonight, those of you who want to come over to our house later. But it's naturally the biggest thought in my mind right now. So even talking about our topic today, I have to relate it to what I've just been experiencing. Without even talking about the difference between countries and cultures, which are real but not decisive, the experience that I was able to have for these last 2 months was unique in this respect, is that I only had one thing to do. And that was I had a whole series of classes and I needed to bring my full energy and concentration to that one effort. And that effort was to share Master's teachings either with people who'd never heard of them or sometimes with Kriyabans. I was working a lot through our centers there, so a lot of the people were highly informed. But for me what it was having a single focus, which in our lives, because our lives are so complicated, it's very rare for us to have the opportunity, even for one day, what to speak of for 2 months, where you have a single focus. And that focus was not even so much that I needed to teach the subject of the chakras or teach the subject of karma or something like that, but it was more the simple idea that I was Master's representative. For all of us who've been part of Ananda, especially for a long time, but for all of us, we have been living this experience that has been to a large extent defined by Swami Kriyananda. Many of you who don't know him very well really don't realize the extent to which it has been defined by Swamiji. Everything about the way Ananda operates has been his inspiration. And out of respect for him and out of the sheer rightness of the situation, everyone in Ananda has always deferred to Swamiji in terms of defining the form, defining attunement, focusing the inspiration, spreading the message, all of those things naturally. Any organization with a strong leader follows the strong leader. That's just the way it is. It's the way it ought to be. Swami is going to be 87 in a couple of months. His spirit is infinite. His body gets weaker and weaker. For those of you who have watched any of his live programs, once he's sitting like this, and he doesn't have to move his body or use it anymore, there's a limitless energy coming out of him. But when he has to even rise from the chair, it takes two people now. He always walks with two people on either side of him. He can't go far with just one. And so you see his incarnation shifting into its final days, even though it is probably its final years. And so many things that have been left in his hands can't be left in his hands anymore, because he just doesn't have the capacity to initiate projects, to initiate global tours and things like that. So what I began to understand, and this is something I think all of us have to think about, is that if Master's mission, if these teachings are really going to spread around the planet, if, as Master said, you know, this self-realization is the religion, the spiritual understanding for Dwapara Yuga. Religion is not the right word, because religions come afterwards, just as we were reading today. Religions are things that are pasted on to true revelation when the masters are gone and lesser minds have to try to make sense of it. But self-realization is that path in which we understand that the relationship with God is entirely personal and is direct. There are no institutional or priestly or ritualistic intercessions required. It's just between us and God, and the extent to which that relationship and that flow of energy is real is entirely up to us. And we can't blame it on anyone else, and we can't put responsibility for it on anyone else. And so these last 2 months traveling, I was representing Master in it's what we always do. But it was so vivid to me that that was the only thing that was being asked of me. It wasn't even necessary for me to be particularly bright about the teachings. I can explain them in an interesting manner, and that certainly helps. But it was self-evident to me as the days and weeks progressed that the only thing that gives us power, the only thing that gives our life meaning, and certainly the only source of joy for us, is the extent to which we have made this direct relationship with God, and the number of minutes in the day in which we can remember that there is no other priority. The thing about the spiritual path that I've noticed over the years is that the simplest teachings are the ones you keep coming back to. Even though we think as we get more sophisticated, we learn more and more, we can quote from the Gita, we understand the Bible, and now we have Patanjali commentary to study. We have all these different sources to draw upon, which give sort of substance and form and complexity and interest to the way we think about these things and the way we express them. But in the end, there's really only one reality, which is we are either conscious of God's presence within us, or we have lost touch with that. And when we're conscious of it, everything that we define as good in our lives starts coming to us. And by that I don't mean worldly success or comfort or anything like that, but an inner sense of being exactly where we're supposed to be, doing exactly what God wants us to do. You know, life is really a whole series of choices. And all of those choices are that we either do those things which move us closer to the Spirit of God within us, or we do those things which move us away from God. And we have it so worked out in our own minds how necessary it is to take care of this business and take care of that and respect this limitation and respect that limitation. And the masters and our friends, everybody around us, supports us completely when we run these little stories, because there's nothing else to do. Each one of us can only move and live and act according to the karmic condition that we have right now. But looking at it from the point of view of the masters, there is a banquet of bliss. There is an infinite level of freedom which is really who we really are and what we're always trying to move toward. But life becomes very complex in our own minds, and we allow all the little things that we're doing to begin to define us. Swami Kriyananda has developed the ability of late to write at a speed which is almost impossible to perceive. He can write a book, as we joke, faster than the rest of us can read it. And then he sat down, and after he'd finished this book, which he wrote in 8 days, he wanted to edit it, and he edited it completely from, not wasn't the first editing, but the final editing in 12 hours. He just went through it like that. And the way he put it was, he said, I don't have to think anymore about whether to do it this way or whether to do it that way. I just look at it and I know exactly how it's supposed to be. In fact, he said, it's become a problem because he's not able, because of the condition of his body for many reasons, his arthritic, his artificial hips and his heartbeat and things like that. He said to sit for endless hours in meditation, so he still wants to keep working. But he says he finishes his project so fast that he's always having to come up with new ones, and he's beginning to run out now. Because they don't take him as much time as they used to take him even. But what I was realizing, just watching him, and he is the proof of the path that we're all on, he's made a whole series of decisions, one after another, on a moment-by-moment basis. And that decision has always been to draw his consciousness back as firmly as he could, as forcefully as he could, and as one-pointedly as he could, to an awareness of God's presence in our lives, to an awareness of the fact of Guru's presence in our lives, to an awareness of the fact that we are Master's representatives in this world, and at all times, we have the opportunity to be his channel. I noticed something about Swamiji from many years ago, that he would always, when we would go out, he would always dress up a little more than was the habit of most of the rest of us. He would often wear a tie, he would often wear a jacket. And I began to appreciate that it wasn't really any sense of formality on his part, although he is of a different culture in a certain sense. He's more European than American. But I began to realize that wherever Swami goes in the world, he's always waiting to tell people that he's a direct disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda. Now, he's not waiting to tell people that because in one way or another he wants to show off or affirm a reality that other people don't have. But whenever he senses the slightest receptivity to a more expanded way of life, then his single focus in life is to step in there and see if he can encourage that. You know, may thy love shine forever on the sanctuary of our devotion. And may I be able to awaken that love in all hearts. Every time we end a service, we always pray that one prayer, because no spontaneous prayer could ever sum it up so exactly. And may I be able to awaken that love in all hearts. What does that really mean? When we awaken that love, what we're awakening people to is we're awakening people to their own nature. We're not awakening them to an outward relationship. Oh, that Master loves you, and that if you love him back, then you know you can have this external thing going on between you. You can call yourself a disciple. You can call him your guru. What we're talking about at all times is the very vibration of our own inner spirit, which is, how are we vibrating? What are we vibrating with? What in this vast world of choices have we attuned ourselves to? And is attuning to that giving us the feeling that we want, the success that we want, the happiness that we want, the sense of security that we want? It was very interesting for me, you know, to be on the other side of the world. For the most part, I was with friends. I mean, for the most part, I was taken care of by friends. I wasn't really on my own, only occasionally. The place where I ended up most on my own was in the city of Calcutta, which is perhaps the most difficult city in India to get around. And just partly because it was a difficult city and Ananda doesn't have its own center there, or doesn't have a well-established center there, I ended up literally staying by myself, having to come and go from the programs by myself, and then meeting people after when I get to the programs, which was a little bit more than I had bargained for. But it was also an extraordinarily interesting experience to be on the streets of Calcutta, which is a very noisy, crowded, just heterogeneous vibrations. That's the best way to think about it. It's just a swirling mass of so much different kind of energy. And my hotel was a walking distance from the place where we were giving the programs. And it was easier to walk than it was to take a cab. The cab ride was just long and complicated, and I also enjoyed the challenge of walking, because here I was with this extremely simple assignment of just to bring to people Master's vibration. And why would walking down the street not be part of that assignment? And it was so fascinating to watch my own consciousness differentiate between what was attractive to me and what wasn't attractive to me, that which I wanted to relate to and that which I didn't want to relate to, what made me feel comfortable, what didn't make me feel comfortable. You know, being in India presents to an American all kinds of energies and sights and personalities that we don't normally encounter here. And this particular street I was walking down was a local market. So it was completely crowded. There were very, very, very few non-Indians there. And, you know, so my sailing along as a single woman dressed in my blue costume was a different look. And so I would forget that I looked different, but I would get that reaction from people. But always there was just this simple thought to try to bring everything back to the place within us in which unity can be experienced, in which we can find that feeling in our own hearts in which we are all united. Swamiji tells often the same stories over and over again. And sometimes it's easy to think, oh, I've heard this story before, and you let your mind tune in to something else. I found it so interesting because I can hear the same stories over and over again, but as my own consciousness changes, then you get closer to what his consciousness is in telling the story, and all of a sudden you see it in a different way. And one of the stories he's been telling us since it happened was the time, I believe he was in Florence, when he had a dream. It came to him in a dream in which he saw all these different kinds of people in the world. You know, not just devotees, but people who are very worldly or very evil even, just living their lives and the way they live them. And behind, as if it were just a translucent curtain, Swamiji saw that the same power of bliss was animating every single person. And even more deeply than that, that all of the diverse actions that we take in this world, I mean, just looking at this temple and looking at all the different people in here, every one of us has a different face. Every one of us has worked very hard for many incarnations to bring us to a unique expression of the spirit. There's no one in this room who looks exactly like someone else. And the reason we all look so different one from another is because the vibration of our chakras, which is the accumulated effect of all our past life experience, the vibration of our chakras manifests as a physical body. And that physical body is an exact reflection of who we are on a subtle spiritual level. And so that spiritual level actually is the animating force for all of this. And what Swamiji has been explaining to us is No matter how diverse that final manifestation, the fundamental force for every single living being, not merely human beings, but every single living being is exactly the same. The search for greater self-awareness, ultimately the experience of bliss. Everyone, as Swami put it, everyone is seeking bliss. And then Swami makes an intuitive leap at that point, which is the part that is so interesting to me. And his intuitive leap is, how can you not therefore love everyone? Because everyone's heart, he is saying, is really the same. We see all these differences. We see all these separating qualities. But everyone's heart is exactly the same. When you go to a culture that's very different, where people look different and live differently, of course, India, like the rest of the world, is gradually just becoming one culture. From when we first started going to India almost 30 years ago to now, it's completely transformed. So the differences are dissolving very quickly. But nonetheless, you're brought into contact with people and personalities that you would not meet on this side of the world. So walking down the street in Calcutta, trying to imagine what Swamiji felt when he felt it in that dream. Every single person here, every single being has the same longing in their heart for bliss, and every single decision that we're all making is in some way to realize that desire. And you're trying to just soften out all that we feel as differences and expand everything that we feel is the same. I was remembering in that same context when Swamiji, when we were together in Disneyland, about 13 or 14 of us with Swamiji, and we were standing waiting for the electric parade to come down Main Street there. And Swamiji looked out at all those hundreds of people and reflecting on Master's own consciousness. And he said, imagine, he said, not merely loving all these people, but knowing yourself as the same as all these people. Actually being one with everyone, everyone. And in that moment when he said that, we all felt so inspired. We sat down on the sidewalk there and started meditating. And we meditated actually for quite some time until the electric parade sort of woke us all out of it. Most of the time in our lives, you see, we're so busy. We get up in the morning, we have a whole to-do list, we just rush, we rush out to the office, we're talking to our business colleagues, we're just trying to keep up with this, we have to do the laundry, we have to get, you know, do our shopping, get clothes, and so on. Everybody's busy with everything. How busy are we with the thought of God? There's no possibility that our lives are going to be different than they are. This is simply not a planet. This is not a time. Even as disciples of Master, this is not the time when we get to just sit down and meditate. Swamiji, sometimes people have brought to Swami certain excerpts from Master's writing about how Master says we should meditate all these hours and just work a little bit, protesting the lifestyle that Ananda has imposed upon us of so much work and so much busyness. And Swami looked at it, he said, oh, that's for a future age, that's not for now. You know, Master put that in there, but not for now. Now is not the time. This is a time in which the world is being transformed. And those of us who have an awareness of where the planet is trying to go have also a responsibility to be part of that. But the simplicity of having had 8 weeks with a single focus has awakened me on a very deep level to the extraordinary importance, no matter what our responsibilities or how complex our lives are, to realize that life has a single focus. And that single focus is that we are either conscious of the divine presence within us or we are not conscious of it. And the extent to which we are not conscious of God's presence within us, we are wasting our time. And it's not our job in the office that is a waste of time. It's not the housework that we have to do that's a waste of time. It's where our consciousness is. that tells us whether we are wasting time or not. And so much of it is about surrendering and accepting and embracing with our entire consciousness whatever God has put in front of us. I was gifted with this experience because my responsibility was to relate to people. My responsibility was to be attentive to them. So no matter what was in front of me, no matter who, no matter what their consciousness, no matter how repetitious their questions, no matter how perhaps difficult their personalities were, because the world is the same on all sides, you know, some people are easier to get along with than others. There was just one responsibility, and that responsibility was to relax into the presence of God and let that unfold. And if I came home with one thought, that is that thought alone. And the realization that for all of us who understand that the divine search has importance in our lives, let us not get confused. Let us not make excuses. But let us try to see wherever we are and whatever we're doing. And you know, in 8 weeks of lecturing, believe me, I wasn't always, you know, sitting in front of people or talking. We were in airports, we were in taxis, we were, you know, all over the place. It's very cumbersome, you know, to get around. So there were many hours of time coming back coming back through Bombay. Coming back through Mumbai. Ooh, I'm sorry, I just have to clear my throat. Coming back through Mumbai, I don't know what was going on, but there were hundreds and hundreds of people just sort of really crowded in close through the check-in lines, through the immigration lines. It was just one of those moments. And it was humbling, is the only way I can say, to just watch how often self-definition asserts itself. You know? And you try to think about how the masters experience everyone on a soul level. And then we watch how reason and intellect divide up the universe. And we get to just practice and practice and practice and practice, practicing the presence of God, practicing being a channel for God, practicing being master's instrument. But the realization that we all need to cling to at all times is the simplest realization of all. It's what Jesus said. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, he said, and all these things will be added unto you. Now, there's so much profound wisdom. That's why that is repeated again and again. We're always thinking, but I need this and I need that. And practicality says this and practicality says that. Jesus says, seek ye first the kingdom of God. And he doesn't necessarily mean, as I said, that we can abandon our duties. Where we need to be seeking it is what are we seeking inside? Where is our consciousness? You know, are we repeating our mantra? Are we thinking of the divine presence? Are we constantly chanting inside? Even when the job is mundane, there's nothing in this creation that is outside the presence of God. The only thing that makes any of our life experience mundane or even material is when we let our consciousness slip away from the divine and become identified with something less. Now there is a glorious and extraordinary power in what these masters have given us. Many years ago, I'll tell this last story, then I'll stop. Many years ago, 1978, 79, Swami Kriyananda was living in San Francisco. He'd come down to help start the San Francisco Center. I was helping him with recording. I was helping him make a tape that later became music for meditation. It was just him alone with a harmonium and one microphone in his apartment late at night. And we would record after all his classes were done. We'd go back to his apartment and he would record for another hour or two. And one night, I had so much trouble I could not make the recorder work, and I'm not good at any of these things. I was just the best available. I couldn't make any of it work, and I struggled for an hour. I was phoning people. I was looking at the instruction books. And at the end of it, that hour, Swami kept sort of, he was meditating, then he'd come out and ask if we could work, and no, I'm not ready. Finally, I said, Divine Mother, if you want this recording to happen, you're going to have to fix this. And then I unplugged every connection. And then I stuck them all back exactly the same way. I didn't change anything, nothing at all. And all of a sudden it worked. The next night, Swami Kriyananda asked me to come up and speak in the middle of his talk. Asha has a testimonial. I said, certainly, sir, what is it? He said, tell them what happened last night. So I understood what he was asking of me. And he'd been talking, teaching superconscious living. I said, you know, these are wonderful teachings. They're brilliantly expressed. They're practical. They're just fabulous. They'll completely change your life if you remember to use them. That's as simple as that. You know, it's all about smriti. It's all about awakening divine memory. And the one thing that we all have to do is remember. Just remember. It's all about my consciousness. It's never about my circumstances. It's never about other people. It's never about anything. It's whether in the midst of whatever it is, I am remembering myself as a child of God. I am remembering myself as an instrument of master. I am remembering myself as a bubble of bliss. And if we do that, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto you. God bless you.